Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Yunus and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm your host, Shelley Carney.
And I'm your other host, Toby Yunus.
Today, we're going to get started with something different. We are going to read Chapter 3 in just a moment, but we're going to start with some emails that we received from some of our viewers, and we do want to encourage you to do the same. Send us your stories, send us your thoughts and ideas, and we'll happily read them to our audience. And this is a story that we received back in early May when we first got started. And it is a little bit ethnic, but it could actually apply to anybody. So I hope this is not offensive, naming an ethnicity.
Well, it happens to be one of my several ethnicities, so I'm not offended at all.
It's about...
As a matter of fact, I've probably told stories like that.
A Mexican family or even a Mexican-American family.
Or a New Mexican family.
Or a New Mexican family, that's right. And we received this story from Maui Bob. And it says, her sick Mexican husband was laying on his deathbed. He had only hours to live when he suddenly smelled tamales. He dearly loved tamales more than anything else in the world, especially his querida chitas tamales, which were known throughout Albuquerque, New Mexico as lo mejor de lo mejor, the best of the best. With every last bit of energy left in his mind and body, the terminally ill husband pulled himself out of bed, across the floor, down the hall, and into the kitchen. Here, his wife was removing the fresh batch of tamales from the stovetop. As he reached for one of the freshly made tamales, his corazón chita smacked him in the back of the head with a wooden spoon. "Leave them alone, pendejo," she yelled. "They're for the funeral." So thanks to Maui Bob for that story that he shared with us.
Pendejo.
Stupid.
Estupid.
Estupido. And corazón chita.
Mm-hmm. Corazón chita. My heart. It's actually corazoncita. Let me see.
No. Does it say chita? Chita is her name, I think.
Where is it showing?
See, chita's tamales.
Oh, yeah. Querida is my dearest, and his corazón, my heart.
Right. Chita. His wife. Mm. All right. So this next one is from Frank S. And this week's email we sent out, which Toby's going to put up on scroll, so you can see it. This week's email, Toby talked about how a picture is worth 1,000 words or even 10,000 words. And we received this in reply to our email. Hey, Shelley and Toby, in reading your message about how a picture is worth 1,000 words, it reminded me of a sales class that my employer's psychologists formulated. The basic part was that our brains are wired differently, but by talking to a potential customer, you can unlock the frame and wiring in their brains that make little sparks fire off in each individual's brain. For instance, if you walk into a home and see the individual's life basically in pictures and visual cues around the home, you're supposed to know after this course that this individual is wired to fire off with visual effects or wording. So as a salesperson, you would mold your words to cue their brains to recognize what makes them click. Like if you want to see pamphlets of whatever you may be selling, their immediate response due to the word see, fires off in their brain. And of course, being very visually framed, they want to see your pamphlet. I hate labeling people like that, but to my salespeople and myself, things changed, both sales approaches and personal relationships. My employer psychologists basically break Americans down into four categories. Visual, 65% of Americans are visually inspired or wired. Auditory, 28% want to hear everything you have to say or also don't want to hear an obnoxious noise. 4% are kinesthetic or wired to feeling or touching the product. The last minor percentages were people that were either all three or two of the above. I used the theory throughout my 37-year career and noticed that more often than not, it was true. If you see all the apps and social media content, most of it is geared to appeal to the biggest percentage of people and includes the auditory percentage also. No wonder our many TVs, phones, rule most of our lives. Listening and watching the two of you, I can't help myself but notice Toby is auditory and Shelley visual and auditory. So the platform you guys run is perfect for you and 93% of the population. Keep up the good work, and I hope this sort of helps, Frank. Well, thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank. We really appreciate that. Yeah. And for your awareness and the sincerity of your letter. So there's another variation on that sales technique, mm-hmm. and it was to be able to walk into the sales calls person's office. And you could tell from the way he was, he or she had their office arranged. So of what kind of personality they were. So if they had like pictures of their kids and mm-hmm. soccer and sports mm-hmm. and fishing, that was one version. If what you went in and you saw stacks of books and data and content, that was another person. There mm-hmm. were four of them. I don't remember them at this point, but mm-hmm. you used it in the same way. So if he had lots of pictures with his kids, you walked in and you said, hey, my kid plays soccer too. What team does your kid play for, kind of thing. So you start, right. That's how you started the conversation.
Bonding.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit of bond.
That's right.
So salespeople, you got to love them.
Yeah. Yeah. You bet.
So what's today's shtick?
So today's chapter is chapter 3. It's called Friday After School. And I'm just going to jump right in. Is that okay?
Yes. But I want you to show the folks that picture that's on the other
again?
Page. Yeah, for the ones who didn't see it last
okay.
week.
If you it's missed it last week.
Because that's the ninth grade graduation class at OLOG. And two of the other people in that picture besides me are involved in this chapter.
Evangeline and Tank. That's true. They are. So they're real, and they're real people.
Well, Evangeline wasn't her real name.
We changed the name to they're real the people, but he changed the name to protect the innocent.
To protect the innocent.
The weather in Santa Fe is sunny and pleasant for early February. I normally have after-school activities, but I'm free on Friday afternoons. I take the opportunity to walk the block and a half to Loretto High School, where my sister Rita and my girlfriend Evangeline go to school. I expect to see them both. My sister to exchange family communications and Evangeline to talk about our immediate future and especially the upcoming spring mixer. The dance is an annual event hosted by Loretto High School. The young ladies of the school circumvent social norms by asking their young gentlemen to accompany them to a formal Sadie Hawkins dance. I assume we will go together since we've been seeing each other for a couple of months. Rita is waiting for me at the corner wearing her school uniform, a blue blazer and blue and gray plaid skirt with stylish black and white saddle shoes. Remember, this is 1964. She is smiling. My father called her his little queen, and she wanted for nothing. In return, she gives everyone in our family cheerful smiles and affection, like a queen bestowing favors upon her people. She greets me with a hug and a kiss on the cheek as she squeals in her little sister voice, Michael, it's good to see you. I've missed you. It's good to see you, too. How are you doing? I respond. I'm getting good grades. I got a new party dress and new shoes, and I have a date picked out for the spring mixer. He doesn't know it yet, though. And you? I'm fine. How's everything at home? All good. Vincent and Paul miss you, too. We talk about you at dinner often and wonder what you're doing at school. Hungry for a family connection, I carefully ask, does Mom talk about me? Rita lowers her gaze to inspect her shoes. Oh, sure. Sometimes. She does when we ask about you. Raising her eyes back to my face, she plaintively asks, Will you come home soon? I miss having you at home. It's good to be missed. I'll try to come home for the weekend, maybe. We'll see. We have a chance to speak about school, our lives, family, friends, and other nonsense for a few minutes before bus number 24, the bus that will take her to our house on Cortez Street in Santa Fe, arrives. Rita climbs into the bus and she sits at the back with one of her friends, her face almost pressed against the bus window, looking out at me. Smiling wistfully, she waves goodbye and blows me a kiss. As the bus pulls away from the curb, Evangeline, sitting at a picnic table in the park along the Santa Fe River on the other side of the street, comes into view. The afternoon sun lights her blonde hair, giving her an angelic aura. I wait for the traffic to give me a chance and cross to join her. Almost immediately, I can tell there is something different about her attitude. My father taught me to be direct and quick to figure out what is wrong when dealing with the women in your life. Putting it off or trying to ignore it only allows the wound to fester, doubling your troubles. Wanting to get right to whatever it is, I greet Evangeline. Hi, is something wrong? Evangeline looks up at me. Seeming to have a hard time looking at my eyes, she focuses on my shirt, then my hands, anywhere but my face. There is a melancholy sadness about her, but she isn't crying, so I don't think it's that serious. She is sensitive by nature. I sit next to Evangeline to comfort her and take her hand in mine. I rest them both on my leg, waiting apprehensively for the unpleasant news. She finally, and courageously, turns directly toward me, her bright blue eyes looking straight into mine, and blurts out, "I asked someone to the spring mixer." My chest constricts as the thought registers in my brain. My beautiful angel just broke up with me. My grip on her hand loosens to let go of her fingers, and she drags her hand back to her own lap. Abandonment seems like the theme of my life. Why am I not used to it by now? I have fallen off my bike and motorcycle a dozen times, abrading the skin of my arms and legs to a messy road rash. But this hurts more. But I don't say that. I remain quiet and let her talk. It was an accidental meeting in the soda shop on the plaza. I don't know what happened. He was sitting next to me at the counter. I knew he was on the football team. We started talking, and before he could walk away, it just came out of my mouth. I couldn't stop myself. She looks into the trees above our heads as if searching for the birds chirping their own conversations and lowers her voice. And he said yes. A maelstrom of feelings and thoughts sail through me, yet I can't settle on any one thing to say. This is now over. Evangeline made her choice, and there is nothing I can do about it. So I give her a soft kiss on the cheek and walk away. Insecurities bob to the surface as I trudge back to St. Mike's. I'm too short. 5'6" is glaringly insufficient, and no girl wants to dance with a guy looking at her neck instead of her eyes, especially with my squinty, muddy brown eyes. Black hair and light brown skin, pocked with embarrassing teenage acne, blends into the background of the small town of Santa Fe. I'm a small, ugly fish in this stupid, stagnant pond. Why would I think any girl would want to dance with me? My throat tightens, but I reject tears and swallow the awful scum of self-hate. I didn't want to go to that dumb dance anyway. I've got better ways to spend my time. Looking up from the sidewalk at which I've blindly been following, I realize I'm back on campus. I pass the handball courts and notice that several of my friends are there. They call out to me and I absently wave at them. Stowing away the pain, I shake myself to awareness. I don't want to dwell any longer on what just happened with Evangeline. I call out, "I'll change clothes and come back out in a few minutes." Then I notice that Tank is there, and I have second thoughts about coming back because he's always such a jerk. I'm not in the mood to laugh off his usual hijinks, but my friends are here, and the need to be with my friends right now outweighs my dislike of Tank. Before I can turn into my dorm to change, Tank calls out in my direction, "Hey, short stuff. Your pretty little girlfriend asked me to the spring mixer. And you know what? I said yes. I thought you might want to know. You'll have to wait for some poor blind girl to ask you to go with her." My entire body bristles at a combination of resentment and shame as Tank's braying laugh spews from his sneering face. jackass. My hands tighten into fists, and I imagine smashing his face to release the boiling stew he cooks up every time he bullies and taunts me. My father also taught me to choose only those battles worth fighting. Tank outweighs and outguns me, and I've had plenty of practice masking anger. Unclenching my jaw and fists, my head fills with blue-gray clouds and a loud buzzing. I walk away from Tank and through the double doors of the dormitory. I've been kicked around enough for one day, so once I get inside, I don't change clothes. I lose any desire to go back outside and flop down on my neatly made bed to stare at the ceiling. I need to get the hell out of here. The movies and television shows I enjoyed watching as a kid present the ideal life that I expected for myself. Dads who come home from work each night, families who talk about their days at the dinner table, and kids who grew up knowing they've got a home and parents who care about them. Where's my Leave It to Beaver life? Climbing out of bed and the depth of this self-induced depression, with a deep cleansing sigh, I walk to the payphone at the end of the dormitory hallway, feed it a dime, and dial my mother at home. After a few rings, she picks up the phone and answers with her traditional and happy, "Aquí está Angelina." "Hi, Mom. How are you doing?" "Oh, mijo. It's so good to hear from you. How are things at school?" "Fine. I like all my classes, and the Christian Brothers are good teachers, especially about life." "I'm happy to hear that. I was hoping you would find your way." I hesitate for a moment, then say, "I miss you guys. Actually, I was calling to ask if you could pick me up tomorrow so I can spend the weekend at home with you all. If you can't, I don't mind walking." Her pause is longer than mine. "I would like that very much, and I'm sure your brothers and sister would too. But you know, I have my hairdresser's appointment on Saturday mornings, and tomorrow afternoon I have to chair a meeting of La Sociedad Folklórica. I don't see how I could do that. Maybe next week?" "Okay, yeah. Next week is fine. I'll call you again next Friday." "That would be wonderful. You take care of yourself. Make sure to tell Brother Bartholomew I said hello." Accepting her excuses as more important than my desire to see my family this weekend, I respond, "I will. Give the kids hugs for me. Tell them I'll see them soon." "Of course," she promises. "Hugs and kisses. Love you. Bye, Mom. Love you." Carefully hanging up the phone, all the things I should have said to my mother pop into my consciousness. "Why did you send me away? Why don't you want me?" I return to open my wardrobe. I pull out and change into my athletic clothes, put on my high-top sneakers, and go downstairs to the gym to exorcise this day's demons with a hard workout. Again, this is from A Gypsy's Kiss, and it's available on Amazon if you're interested. We'll put the link in the description box. And that was chapter 3 today that we were reading. And Toby, what do you think is the theme of this chapter?
Well, before I answer that question, I want to compliment you on your Spanish. That was really well handled.
Well, thank you.
So
I did grow up in the Southwest, so yeah, that helps.
So I think the theme, I'm hesitant to call it abandonment because it's a sense of abandonment. Nobody's really abandoning me. Mm-hmm. I just feel like they're abandoning me. And so much of our lives is dependent on how each of us interprets the situations that arise in our lives. And so as a teenager, having been rejected by your girlfriend, your worst enemy on campus, and your mother, that starts to feel like abandonment, when in reality it was situational, right? And as you sit there and imagine all the possibilities that could have otherwise happened, it gets progressively worse. Then by the end of the day, you're convinced that no one cares about you. And that's how I think things like anxiety is stimulated, or depression is stimulated, or all the things that come as a result of that. And if it happens too regularly to you, not that the abandonment actually happens, but your belief that it actually happens, then you start experiencing all of that more regularly, and pretty soon it becomes part of your makeup. And that's how your personality forms. And when people say, you know, I don't like hanging around with Toby. He's always so negative. Mm. That's the result of living on that side of the algorithm, but you have to believe it side of the algorithm, as opposed to, hey, weird day, man, you know, let's go to the gym and do a workout, you know, rather than believing the entire world has abandoned you, because they haven't. They're just doing other things. So I don't think we called it a sense of abandonment, right? The chapter's not titled that.
No. It's like Friday.
Yeah, Friday after
school. Friday after school.
Yeah. But, and I think the theme I think it's an accurate representation of the theme, that sense of abandonment that child is experiencing. And he has so many other reasons to believe that. You know, losing his father, his mother sending him off to boarding school in the same town, etc. But it wasn't there. He had people that loved him. He had
represented in this chapter by the sister Rita,
right? Mm-hmm. And he had people that cared about him, his friends. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't as dire as he was making it sound in each of these cases,
right?
And you could
look at that phone call, and you could say, "Oh, well, she wouldn't take him home." But you could also see at the same time, she had reasons for it. And, you know, it wasn't anything that he didn't already know.
Right.
That he knew that she was part of that folklorica sociedad, and that he knew she always get her hair done on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And when she said all these things, it was just like, oh, yeah, uh-huh, that's right. I forgot, you know. Mm-hmm. And then as we go on, of course, we know that there are you have other things to do, too.
Right.
It was just that feeling of, you know, you just saw your sister. She wants to see you. Evangeline kind of hurt your feelings. So it's like, I just want to go be comforted. Mm-hmm. Right.
And not that. So my mother, honestly, for as good a woman as she wasn't the comforting type. Like, there was not a lot of, like, oh, come here, mijito. There was the occasional hug. I remember her taking me to her, making me put on my uniform one of the times I came back from Vietnam to take me to her school so she could introduce me to everyone. Mm-hmm. There was that kind of thing. But she tended to be, bless her heart, and this is not a criticism, nor is it anything that I didn't like about her. She was pretty self-centered. Conversations with her was always like conversations like, speaking with Spanish royalty. That's how I always felt. Just don't bother me. Find the maid. She will care for you. That's how it always felt to me, you know. She came from a long line of, you know, Spanish nobility, and I think it was in her blood. So maybe part of her disappointment in me was the fact that I was just a run-of-the-mill guy and didn't have that royal blood in me or something. It was fun. She was fun. Don't get me wrong. She was funny. She was smart. She was talented. She could dance. She played the piano by ear, those kinds of things. She was an all-around, you know, healthy personality. But she had some missing things, and one of the missing things was she was better with a husband than without. Because I think that made it feel organized to her, and she could play her role as the wife and mother. And when my father passed, I think it was, well, of course, it was, I say it was at least as difficult. It was far more difficult for her than it was for any of us. So, but the other thing that was important about this chapter is it sets up the challenges of making decisions like leaving. And now you have an excuse. Nobody cares about me anyway. Nobody's going to care if I leave and go out. It's, you know, it's that third subchapter of the first section of the hero's journey where you need some sort of stimulant, and the stimulant is nobody cares about me anyway, you know. I think the line that sticks with me through that chapter is, I've got to get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have an excuse. Nobody loves me anyway. Let me get the hell out of here. I just got to figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That was brought on by that side. No, nobody loves me. My sister gave me a little kiss on the cheek, and that was enough. My girlfriend left me for the guy that I hate most in the world, and my mother doesn't want to see me. Why do I need to stay around here? So, it's classic teenager thinking.
Right.
And you can get trapped in it. You have to make sure that some of that doesn't occur the rest of your life, where you look for excuses about being angry about something, you know, whatever it is. And lots of people can do that.
Yeah.
it ends up, you end up in a better place if you can get past it, deal with it, get past it, because getting past it sometimes is not enough either. Just walking and saying, bullshit, nobody, I don't care. That's not, what's important is to analyze what you're feeling, why you're feeling it, and what you need to do about it so you don't get stuck with that feeling from that point forward every opportunity to give. There have been plenty of other situations in my entire life where I could have claimed that I was, quote, abandoned, unquote. But the part of learning to deal with it, you'd recognize, oh, it's not abandonment. It's the end of a chapter or a section in your life. And it's not going to kill you. And you can move on with whatever you need to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of the lesson that I wanted to learn in that chapter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of the reason we as human beings all have a fear of abandonment is because our ancestors had a tribal mentality that if you were not integral to the tribe, if you were abandoned by the tribe, maybe, you know, especially if you were in a tribe that was nomadic, you know, or was moving, you had to keep up with them. If you got abandoned, very likely you would die because you didn't have the rest of the support that you needed to have food and shelter and all of that. So that, I think, is just part of our DNA makeup. So we all have some fear of abandonment. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other part of it is a fear of abandonment is very much self-centered. It's all about me, and I'm not having my needs met, and me. Yeah. That is something that we have when we're small, and as we become teenagers, we start to understand, like we talked about, our world is starting to expand. Mm-hmm. We're starting to meet people from other places and see that, you know, they have problems too. What? You know, and you know, we start to open up to other people and understand that it's not all about me all right. the time. I'm not the sun. The world doesn't revolve around me. I'm just one of many people in this school, in this town, in this state, you know, and I play my part, but it isn't always all about me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we learn that as we grow.
Most of the time, it's not about you. You accept that and you figure out what to do with it, you know. So anthropologists will tell you, evolutionarily speaking, there was a point at which the tribe, which was starting to form, right? The concept of tribe was starting to form. If someone was unable to keep up, whether they were elderly or sick, they would simply be left behind, right? And they would be left to die. There was a point at which we made an evolutionary change, probably genetic, where we believed it was more important for us to care for those that couldn't keep up and keep them as part of the tribe until we could care for them enough to bury them. And that's when you start seeing, you know, in the evolutionary scale, you start seeing the point at which humans started burying their dead. Before that, it was just bones by the side of a river or whatever it was. But we actually made an evolutionary change as a result of some kind of genetic component. And that genetics, as follows, is the majority of people, right, would rather be part of one or more groups. A family group, a club group, a gold prospecting group, a travel around New Mexico group, you would much rather be part of a group than not. And that's probably genetically what is made, because it took that kind of group think, the fact that groups are more powerful as a group than individuals in the group, the group is the greater than the sum of the parts, right? And that's probably genetic for us now. There was a point at which it wasn't. And because it's genetic, when you're out of a group, I mean, especially teenagers, for them to fall out of a group is horrendous for them. It's like the end of their whatever their world happens to be at that point in time. And part of it is that, the rejection associated with it. But it's also genetic. There's a very strong genetic component for us to want to belong. And that's why we form groups. And that's why, again, groups, the sum of the parts are greater than or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And I think that's good for us. I think it's gotten us this far. Now it gets us into trouble because then we become And I think that's where we're at right now. We're just a little bit too tribal.
Mm.
And that's not necessarily our fault, as it is the combination of communications, the evolution of communications, and the fact that there are people out there willing to take advantage of that.
Divisiveness.
Well, I don't. So the divisiveness is a byproduct of their desire, of that individual's desire to be different in a way that makes them unique. And we're not going to get into the politics of these things right now. The divisiveness comes because whatever the element is, it's used as a way to identify the tribe, right? You don't like chocolate sodas. And I don't like chocolate sodas. Because chocolate sodas are the reason that society hasn't been able to keep it. And I'll give you all the reasons. And then you realize, you know what? He's right. I don't like chocolate sodas. So we start forming a little group, all the people that don't like chocolate sodas. And we talk about how much we hate chocolate sodas. And then eventually we start talking about the people that do like chocolate sodas. And there's something different about them. They're weird. They like chocolate sodas. And we know that God doesn't want us to have chocolate sodas. So that's how that happens, and it's okay. and it's most visible right now in the United States. The politics that we're experiencing right now, that politics of divisiveness, isn't a recent. I'm going to say it started probably in the late 80s, early 90s, and it has evolved. But there were political operatives that realized, from a political perspective, you could take advantage of that and create something that you liked, that you made sure that the people that were like you liked it. And then you told them about what they didn't like, and you start focusing on that. You don't focus on the fact that yummy chocolate shakes are really, really good. You start focusing on the fact of what's wrong with the people that don't like chocolate shakes. There's the problem. They don't like, what could be wrong with them that they don't like chocolate shakes? That's today's politics. Yeah. That's exactly what it's about.
Yeah. And in the end, we're all humans and we are all connected. We are separated only by 6 degrees from everybody in the world, basically. So, yeah, let's focus on that.
Why not?
And we don't have to feel abandoned. It's a matter of perspective.
And if you want to see how connected you are to everybody else in the world, do yourself a favor and get one of those genetic tests. They've fallen to like $60. Find out your genetics. And the next thing that you do as part of that is they start informing you of relatives that you have by 6 or 7 or 8 degrees. And suddenly you're related to people living in Sardinia. Who knew?
Yeah. Yeah. Business card. Like all kinds of.
This was one of my favorite business cards. It had Shelley on one side and me on the other.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about your relationship with Rita, because here, you know, it always struck me that you would say she would kiss you or hug you or blow kisses. And I'm like, that's a brother and sister. That wasn't my experience of how it was between me and my brother.
So it wasn't necessarily between she and me. She was like that with everybody, with her other brothers, especially the youngest one, Paul. She called Paul Baby Paul, you know, and I think she called him that until he passed away at the age of 32, you know. So she was like that with everybody. She was just that kind of loving and expressive. And it was almost in, I don't want to say a comical way, but in the same way my mother was like Spanish royalty. Sean was our little queen bestowing. Rita was our little queen bestowing her affections on everyone. So there was a bit of an act in there, but it became part of her personality as well. And it wasn't until later, I think college spoiled her, in my opinion, because she started using drugs. And that became a part of her life. And I think that became a debilitating part of her life. So. But she was very, I don't want to say romantic. She was very loving and she was like that with everybody, you know, that was just kind of her way. So, it was a good relationship. I think, like I said, I came back from Vietnam one time, and she was down at school at New Mexico State, and she asked me to go visit her. And by this time, my other brother had wrecked my car. And so I decided, well, hell, I'll hitchhike down. So I hitchhiked down to New Mexico State and went to, she had an apartment with a guy who a little skinny blonde guy from Chicago, whose name was Phil. And I almost immediately didn't like him because he said something about the military that just kind of, you know, but he was the one that, as a matter of fact, I probably shouldn't tell this. Well, I can't. Nobody's alive. When I got there, the house smelled funny and it smelled like marijuana. But what was interesting is the blender was going, the you know, regular blender. And they had thrown a bunch of marijuana leaves and seeds and all these things in there. And they were trying to blend it up to turn it into something, like they want to be able to smoke it. And they had forgotten about it because they were already hiring a kite. So by the time I got there, I walked in the kitchen, the blender was on. I didn't know what it was. And I turned it off and it was just a powdery substance. And I said, hey, anybody home? You know, that kind of thing. And they were in the bedroom. They came out, just, you could tell they had just been smoking marijuana. And this was before it was legal, of course. And high as a kite, she gave me a hug and a kiss and things like that. I said, your blender was on. And they start laughing. And they laugh in that marijuana laugh kind of way where it's just everything's really funny. Everything's funny. Well, this was funny. And they said, oh, you forgot the blender, man. You know, I'm going to do a terrible job of, because I have my, in my head, what it's like to be high on marijuana. I don't know what it feels like. So they laughed about that for a while. And then they decided to make brownies. And they looked around, they were going to make brownies, and they didn't have some of the ingredients. So one of them found some pancake flour, and they made pancakes with the marijuana powder. And they ate pancakes with honey and, I mean, with syrup and butter the rest of the night, continuing their high. But I saw that night, I remember seeing, and by this time she was probably in her junior year. She eventually graduated. I got to say that for her. She was a journalism major. Mm. And she did not know I was a journalist. I never told anybody in my family that I was not a pre-law major, that I was a journalism major. So she went into that, but you could tell that there was something different about her in her sense of who she was. She seemed to be an extension of this creepy little Chicagoan guy that I immediately didn't like. But after that, drugs. And I don't mean hard drugs. I don't ever, I mean, she didn't, not to the best of my knowledge, didn't use heroin and things. It was a lot of alcohol and marijuana. And they became a significant part of her life. And so I think that's the point at which she started changing from that personality that I recall. Mm-hmm. And then each time I'd meet her, she seemed to be angrier at me. I think part of what she resented was the fact that I left New Mexico, that I, like my father, had left her. And I think that caused a lot of her anger, and she was pretty angry at me right up until her end.
Mm-hmm. So when we feel abandoned by somebody, sometimes that's how we react. We, you know, have a pattern. We develop a pattern of behavior. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're abandoning me. So, you know, I'm angry because I need you here with me to be a part of my life and to, so that I know who I am, because, you know, I only know who I am when my family's around me. Of course, that's again, it's very self-centered. Uh-huh. The fear of abandonment is a very self-centered feeling. Uh-huh. But what we kind of end up doing sometimes in order to get people to stay with us, like she may have done with this Phil person, is we, you know, kind of disappear ourselves a little bit to become more like them, right, so that they won't abandon us.
Yeah.
Oh, well, he likes people that use marijuana and drink, so I'm going to do those things so that he doesn't abandon me. And that could have been her fear of abandonment, you know, overcoming her good choices, her common sense, her good judgment. Uh-huh. And that's how it manifested in her. How did your abandonment issues manifest?
First, I want to bring up something with her in that conversation. So I experienced a lot of guilt over the life that, especially the life she led, but that none of my brothers and sisters ended up having good lives, right? The brothers both died at a very young age. Her life was dominated by alcohol and drugs. One of her sons committed suicide, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a little bit of guilt associated with that. And so I started to recognize that sense of abandonment as a result of having felt like I was abandoning her. And so I got very cautious about experiencing it, because like everything else in life, you have to let yourself experience it, right? You have to believe it's happening, and then you have to experience that hangover. Oh my God, I feel terrible. I've been abandoned, right? So you have the hangover, you can enjoy the hangover, you can enjoy the regret associated with the hangover, and it's part of your feelings, but it's part of that feeling that you like having, because you can tell people I was abandoned. You're going to have the story.
Wallowing
in that terrible feeling and having to be able, you know, and you've met people like that. I know I've met people like that, where you talk with them and all they talk about is the number of times. As a matter of fact, I have an ex-girlfriend whose whole life was about the people that had left her, you know, and if you had a couple of glasses of wine, she would start with it. And I kept trying to get her out of that. Like, now that's your past. You have to get past that.
Yeah. So, tell a different story.
So
they don't want to.
I'm trying to think of after that early period, where there were times that I felt abandoned, and I can say to myself, I didn't feel abandoned. I had breakups. I had things, relationships that dissolved. We went our different directions. But I think that was the last time that I started feeling abandoned. Now, if one of my daughters, oh, I'm sorry. There is one time. Right.
Yeah.
And I've let it go. I haven't wallowed in it. I haven't allowed myself the luxury of just being whiny about it. I went on with it. Is there anything that I would like to happen because of that? Yeah, I'd like that somehow to come back together, but I accept the fact that it's likely not. So, but I never felt, I can honestly say I don't feel abandoned. As a matter of fact, I remember taking responsibility for it. Like, this is my fault. Right? Here's what I did wrong in that situation. I think that's a better way for me to look at it. May not be better for everybody to look at it, because then you end up, if you have a lot of those situations in your life, you end up blaming yourself for a lot of negativity in your life. But by this time, I had gotten rid of the need to feel abandoned. That was past it. So when it did happen, I could look at it and say, man, I wish that hadn't happened, but it did. And I didn't choose that, right? I could feel miserable enough to claim, it was my fault. I forced them into that situation. And, you know, if I hadn't done this, or you could look at it and say, I could have handled that better. And you just have to wait for, you know, whether it's fate or destiny or something, to put it all back together for you, if that's what's going to happen. And at the same time, you have to accept the fact that it may never happen. So you could spend the rest of your life focusing on that, or you could spend the rest of your life focusing on the strong relationships that you have and that you enjoy, and then enjoy having relationships with you.
Yeah. Another reaction sometimes to the idea that somebody's going to abandon me. Somebody is like, for instance, maybe they're moving because of a job or whatever. And then you think, I'm being abandoned. So before they can tell me that they're, you know, never going to speak to me again, I'm going to tell them I'm never going to speak to them again. Mm-hmm. And they just cut off all ties and they say, you know, I abandon you. How do you feel about that? You know, and this is sort of a passive aggressive way, cutting off your nose to spite your face, saying, you know, I feel like they're going to abandon me, so I'm going to abandon them first. Mm-hmm. I win.
Right.
And it's not, nobody wins.
Nobody wins. And it's not a win-lose situation.
No.
Right. My father was the master of the encapsulation of ideas, right? And one of the things that he would say is change isn't personal, right? You can't take change personally. So if there's a nuclear war, don't take it personal, you know? If there's if somebody leaves you, don't take it personal. It's just change, you know? And so that, I don't know necessarily that I can honestly say that I live by the principles my father instilled in me from a distance, because he wasn't ever, we didn't have those conversations, right? I was too young for those kinds. If I'd been in high school and I'd called to say that Evangeline just dumped me, his response would have been, change isn't personal. Don't take it personal, you know? So so that's kind of how you have to look at it. It's not, that's not personal. If you, you can make it personal if you want to, but why? We got enough things going on in our very complicated life today to not have to make stuff up that makes it worse.
Right.
Yeah.
Try to focus on the good things that happened in the day instead of the less good things. Yeah. Yeah. And find the gift in the change rather than the burden, I think. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've thoroughly explored chapter 3 and the theme of the fear and the feeling of being abandoned. And
well, let me ask you a question. You read that chapter.
Yeah.
Did he have a right to feel abandoned?
Well, yeah.
And I'm speaking in the third person here now. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and of course, we wrote it that way. I mean, mm-hmm. that didn't all happen in one day.
No.
But we wrote it that way because we're setting up the adventure. But yeah, in each case, there is a feeling of abandonment, and you get to choose whether you're going to wallow in it,
as
like
usual.
We talked about,
yeah.
Or can you find the good in that? You could look at the meeting with Rita and say, okay, well, she loves you. She misses you and wants to see more of you. That's a really good feeling. Or you could focus on, oh, I didn't get to go home with her on the bus. You know, it's your choice. You get to choose what to focus on. So, yes, of course, everybody has a right to their feelings. Mm-hmm. So if he wanted to feel abandoned, he could. But if he wanted to say, focus on the good stuff, focus on the love and the family that you have, rather than the lack thereof, then, yeah, I think, you know, you can have a much happier life that way.
So I, you know, I hadn't thought about this till we started having that particular part of the conversation. So my sister, the girl that we call Evangeline in the book, and the girl whose real name was Evangeline, were all on the cheerleading team. They cheered for the St. Mike's sports teams, right? Because they didn't have any of their own sports teams. When the girl we call Evangeline, I guess I could use her name. She's not around anymore. Her name was actually Lauren. Right. When Lauren turned me down, I went back, and Evangeline, the real Evangeline, who I had kind of a crush on, invited me to the mixer. So I went with someone, enjoyed the night, had a wonderful time, waved at Lauren and Tank. And
see, these are really things that did happen.
Yeah.
But we squished them together.
We squished them together. Yeah.
That's what makes it.
Yeah. The reason, honestly, the reason I picked Evangeline for the pseudonym, right? And Evangeline wasn't in our school. She wasn't at OLOG. That picture here, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's Lauren. There's no Evangeline. She came from one of the other schools. Mm-hmm. That is Tank.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Lauren. And I picked Evangeline because it was a name that I remembered, you know, from my high school years. And it was, we used to call her the Yaya girl because she had green eyes and dark hair, and you'd tell her something and she'd laugh and she'd go, yeah, yeah.
Eunice repeat.
Yeah, Eunice repeat.
All right. Did you have anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up?
That is more high school stories than I ever imagined myself talking about. Okay. Anyway. So yeah, I don't have it.
Yeah. We're going to leave it at that because I think that was a nice long show. We hope that you enjoyed it, and maybe it sparked some ideas and some memories, some patterns that maybe you recognize in your own life. And if you'd like to share that with us, please do write to us at stories at agkmedia.studio, and we'd love to, you know, read your email on our next show. So write to us. And if you have not yet signed up for our email newsletter that comes out every Tuesday, you can do that at news.agkmedia.studio, and you'll get to read our little stories about how a picture's worth a thousand words and other good things. So hope that you'll do that.
And don't forget, we have two other YouTube channels. One is called New Mexico Day Trips, where we talk about the travels. We record the travels that we make in New Mexico. And the other is Garage Prospecting, where we talk about the gold that we're finding. So I won't promote them any more than that, but take a look at them. We have fun with those two other channels as well.
And we'll see you again next time on Our Story, Your Story.
Should I have finished that?
Yeah.
Oh.
No. Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.